April 11, 1996. As far back as you can go.
On my dad's side, his parents came over from Italy. My grandfather was around 1912, and my grandmother was around 1912.
Your mother's name sounds.
Yeah. A long time. And grandmother was born in Illinois and moved out to Seattle. Yeah. Relatively young age, my grandfather was from Massachusetts. I'm not sure. I'm not sure found out how he got to Seattle and got there as a young man. Maybe he came to Alaska first. Spent some time in Alaska. And a couple of years ago, working with. Moved back to Seattle and he always had the fond memories of the last time he was there. And got the opportunity to move up here in the middle of the street.
When he first moved here in Alaska, was it right here in Kodiak?
No, it was in the Copper River Delta near a town called Chipmunk, which is still over there. It's kind of a ghost town.
You mentioned something about Italy. Where in Italy?
Rico da Como.
Oh.
Near a town called Campobasso.
Okay, is that in the Sicilian?
No, it's about 130 miles southwest of Rio. We went there.
Is it? Okay.
Is it beautiful?
I live in Catania, Sicily.
Oh, Sicily.
Okay, how about school? Could you tell me something about school? I assume that you went to school here in Florida.
Yeah, I went to kids' case when I graduated from Florida.
And I assume you have kids also in the school.
Yeah.
Could you tell me something about the difference that you see from the time that you were going to school, the changes that had occurred, let's say, reading the number of size of the kids in her classroom versus today's
school? Yeah, I don't. It seems like the classes may have been bigger than they are now. But I don't really recall. I went to about the first 6 years, I went to a school I'm downtown about one of the pretty afternoon companies. And it was after the. We had been condemned many times before the student time. Any place else to put kids, so we accepted anything.
Is that a public school?
Yeah, it was a public school. And when I got to the 7th grade, I had to go up to Maryland to do an Ohio school. Classes were smaller. It was much smaller school system. This school didn't make sense. Grade school and high school was all housed and there was not much in the community of college. My graduating class was in 1969, was about 80 students. I think that's probably the same relationship with my graduating class now. And my son graduated this year.
issues?
Yeah.
Okay, what kind of problems do you see the students now face in Caribbean?
A lot of peer pressure gets more complex than we end up with,
mm-hmm.
in terms of gang, drugs. Mm-hmm. There was drugs, the drug of choice when I was in high school was alcohol. The marijuana was a little tiny bit of it around, but it was, it wasn't a problem. Now, the drugs and alcohol are involved in much more in the childhood than gangs. That pressure is kind of involved with them. There's a certain romance about him or something, and he talks about it a lot. And the tough times and then the racial thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of upsetting to me that most of his friends are Hispanic, and there's pockets of racial pockets that Hispanics don't like the Filipinos, the Filipinos don't like the Hispanics, they don't like the whites, they don't like the other Asians or something. When I was in school, it was basically natives and then Caucasians, and then there's always a few Filipino people, and we never really looked at each other as different. We didn't know anything.
Could you perhaps close up some ideas of what or where you think it might be coming from? Because I assume that there were lots of Filipino food during the time.
No, not really a lot. Most of them were Navy kids.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy kids were
there.
And we didn't. If anybody was on the bottom rung, it wasn't the kids of Asian extraction, it was kids of being Native. If somebody made racial slurs, it was against Native people. One or two black kids in the school, but never any more than that. So they weren't viewed as a whole lot different. We knew they were different color and stuff, but they were enough. There wasn't enough for them to be a racial identity, so they mixed in with the rest of us. There wasn't any more.
Did you probably notice too? I was going through the list that were already done the interviews for Dungeons or other classes that Gary had. And oil business has never been one that has been interviewed or brought up. So I said, this is a big thing here in Alaska. Nobody had even thought about that. So I think it's really fascinating to understand how this is coming about the business. Who did your family start the business in
1950?
Was it here in Victoria?
Right here.
Now, when you, I assume it's your father who started it?
No, my grandfather.
Oh, really? So, how how did he start the business?
It was Union Oil Company that he was the first Union Oil Company distributor in Korea. They called the companies back then. And Union Oil had a contract to service aviation gas to several airlines all over Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to be able to provide it in all the locations in the place of Korea. So, they decided to put a Korea out so they could service the contract. And they lost the contract after just a few years. And the tanks, most of the tanks are original. A couple of our buildings are original for most of the years. And part of the dock structure, everything you see here is built on steel, which is all over the water that we cover.
During the 50s, where did you get the supply and how were your supplies transported?
Well, until 1978, Union Oil supplied the plant out of California tankers. There were 5 minutes of ship that would come in on a regular basis. And by the time I started working here, I kind of monthly, we had to get a tanker in. So this is quite a lot of California.
You said that most of the structures that you have here are the regional ones. I gather there was a great tsunami that came from before. Was any of the structures?
The building that's in there, the building that the garage, the corrugated metal buildings, were built on a dock. This was on the dock, and the water came in and filled it in, and it tore the decking off, and the building pulled it up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, they looked at things different from now. They just came in and just bulldozed it came down to pick it up. But back then, the value of salvaging the buildings was still there. They salvaged the buildings, brought in fill, and then the buildings and kind of injuries.
What about oil spill? Did you have any?
That wasn't even an issue back then. If you drained a hose or something, you just drained it into the water. You couldn't do things today that you could do.
So basically, you say that there was no federal regulation as far as
environmental stuff happened in the early 70s. I started working when I was going to college. I started working in 1971. But I didn't start full time until
1975.
We didn't worry about stuff. I remember a spill off of a tanker and it was having about 7 feet. And we had to try and clean it up the first time.
What sort of like a guidelines, I would imagine in 1971, if the environment was already formed a group, they must have some sort of guidelines, although not as specific as the ones that we have now.
I don't know what the guidelines were. You weren't supposed to get any oil in the water, and if you did, you were supposed to get in trouble. That's the way it was with 75 years.
Did they impose any type of fines?
No.
Did they just say?
They were kind of slapped on the wrist, but I only remember the one incident, and it was wasn't a whole lot.
When you're talking about oil spills, then I would imagine why it's not as great as the ones that we have nowadays. So, in comparison, would you consider them as minor incidents?
Before?
Yeah.
No, people would indiscriminately spill. And I remember working here, going to college and stuff, guys would put the hoses in and they would just drink coffee and we'd go by and there's food going all over the place and you'd get a chef to hold off and yell out and they'd come out. And they'd be angry for that. They'd fuel down in the water and they wouldn't have to pay for it. Nobody can have much of a concern until the first part comes and if you didn't buy the building and play the 7 years.
Do you think that could have added to some of the depletion of some of the fish?
Not at all, because the years after that were some of the biggest years for crab and shrimp and they weren't that big. It would be 50 to 100 gallons or something like that. Could it happen? That's how much attitude has changed now. It's pretty much easy to follow.
Is it because of the strength of the environmental food, or is it because finally we're feeling the effects?
Well, no, I think it's the effects that are related to the laws and the people to enforce them. Before there wasn't anybody to enforce them. When the Exxon tank was the law, that triggered all of this stuff. Big oil process, little oil lots of time.
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, that's my next one, is the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Now we are all aware about the threat that is on the environment of the wildlife as well. Now, what kind of pressure can you ensure there is to the environment of the organization carried on oil companies now?
There's kind of the crude oil side is big oil, like molten Chevron, big names that you recognize. And refined oil has become smaller companies now. In the scope of things, we're one of the small companies in Alaska now. We do have one plant, companies like Special Marine and something like that. They're getting to be larger, but we still share the same common problems of not an unlimited amount of time. And after the Exxon, the state of Alaska and the federal government passed all of these laws to make sure that that couldn't happen again, and to do all these things to these big oil companies, well, you know, that's what they just said oil, you know, and so we're living with a lot of things that had we probably would have gotten here eventually, but it would have been much more organized and much more directed to our exact needs, and it could have been done rationally. And there's some real horrendous demands put on us that we're trying to fulfill now, and kind of getting into
what kind of changes that you, as in your own group, would like to see? You said there's a lot of pressure, there's a demand that might not be even related to your
They're probably kind of hard to explain to somebody outside the industry. One of the things we have to do is we have to put an impermeable liner around all of our tanks. So if we run a tank over, or a tank breaks, it's not going to come in the ground. But when you get into a wreck, the chances of us running the tank over are fairly slim. It's a definite possibility. But we put in this liner around there, and now water seeping through the ground will kind of handle a lot of the rainfall. Now we're going to have to catch rainfall and manage, you know, 1 to 2 million gallons of water a year that's going to be collected up there. Things like that. Those are the kind of issues that we're facing. A lot of equipment upgrades to prevent spills.
How often do you have to double check and see if your equipment are up to par with the
We have a schedule that we set up, and we're supposed to check on our spill equipment so many times a year. We're supposed to do some wet drills a year where we actually put a boat in the water and pull it around and physically do stuff, and so many kind of dry drills where we just get in the office and say, well, this happened, what are we supposed to do when people are right now?
So that's all this training?
We do it, or we bring somebody in. We do most of it ourselves. Most of it's just common sense. We just have a spill off the dock, what are we going to do? We've all done the drill.
Do you provide some sort of training to the personnel that goes to handle the fuel and how do they get that?
We provide that. Most of the training when something like this is on the job.
So you don't have, like to say, every year they need so many hours?
Yeah, that's the environmental type stuff.
Do they need to be certified?
There's a certification called HAZMAT for hazardous material workers.
We're running very fast on this one. I wonder if I can fill out my 10 pages here. Okay. hypothetical scenarios. There's an oil spill in Kodiak as big as that one in Prince William's town. Let's say it's your company who... Okay, just by saying a hypothetical question. What would you do?
Terminal discharge and prevention contingency plan and EPA response plan of discharge. All three government agencies as far as that is concerned to put it together. We basically pull that off the shelf, open it up, and it tells us who we're supposed to call, what we're supposed to do, and all that. It's about 250 pages.
Do we have the personnel in the area that will have a quick response?
We have an operating agreement with Petro Marines, and one of us has a problem with it and is calling it. So that doubles our force. There are some other, a few other things that are going on. We belong to a bill of what called Alaska Should Do. And
what's the base for that?
Shadoo is the office is in Anchorage.
How do you spell that?
It was formed by the oil transport, refined oil transporters in the state because we need to have coverage in order to transport oil, and then Kodiak Oil Sales Company is non-transported to join within the idea of it. And we have probably about $80,000 worth of equipment, 80 or 100,000, maybe more than that, equipment right in Kodiak. Two 40-foot van loads of boom and pumps. To respond to that one. That's in addition to the resources that Kodiak Oil Sales So we have the capability of equipment-wise of a pretty good response on water response. We did a drill last year and we had a hypothetical spill. We responded with our own personnel. While we were responding, we called Captain Marine and showed up with personnel and equipment and assisted our people. It was a joint drill.
Where did you do the drill?
Right off the top. And then Alaska Should Do had brought in a team to help do training for us. And so we started our spill, we activated the other resources and they were brought down. And within 1 hour of being in, it happened, we had 3 boats in the water, 20 people on the scene, I think 2,000 feet of boom in the water. We had the whole thing boomed out. I think it was less than
1 hour. Oh.
We were prepared for it. We got another drill. Same scenario with DPC. About 2 weeks later, it was an unannounced. And when they have an unannounced, they just tell you, in this month period, we're going to show up and you have to do what we say. Department of Environmental Conservation and State. And we did the same drill with, we didn't deploy the bigger resources. But we did have Petro Marine respond and we surrounded the spill and had the cleanup underway in less than
35 minutes.
The Coast Guard and DEC were happy. They said we would have next time consider that the tide might be moving this way and we might want to do this. Those things aside, they were
How often do they do that?
You have an unannounced drill at least once every 2 years. And when they say an unannounced, they give you a month in which they're going to do it. And in my case, I was getting ready to go on a trip or something. And so I called them up and they squeezed the time frame.
Mm-hmm.
Or I was going to be out of town at the beginning of the deal for about a week. And so they moved the deal up.
Okay, let's say they did the drill, mm-hmm. and you were out of town. Who's going to head it up?
Well,
and
did,
who's going to be leading?
We have other people designated in the plan that would be in charge.
Oh, okay.
And having them at the women in the office know what they're supposed to do. Their job is to make calls and mm-hmm. do some observation. And some guys like to be in the boat, so they let the guys mm-hmm. do what they want to do, but everybody is, does enough training so they know how to run the boat.
So, 250 pages of
notes
you have?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly because it's trying to satisfy three agencies. And there's a lot of stuff in there that we would never, that is required to have it. Because discharge prevention and contingency. And in the plan, the outline improvements that were.
How often do they update their contingency plan?
Different agencies are different, but it's basically somewhere between 2 and 3%. EPA is way out there, in the States, 3 years. And I think the EPA has a longer time frame because they know that the states are requiring that to move.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you now on the lighter side, I'm going to give you a little break. would you share some of the colorful stories about Kodiak? I think you've been here since forever, almost. just talking with some people, they say that there's a big change in Kodiak, maybe with more transportation, more people, what other things can you share?
Well, Kodiak has changed, it's become a lot more civilized in the last 20 years, I guess.
What do you mean by civilized?
It used to be a lot more frontier spirit. The fishermen are always a little independent. People are, a lot of these guys, if they weren't doing this, they'd probably be in charge of a corporate, big corporation or something. A lot of them are that smart. They don't fit in that kind of a mold. They're real independent, risk takers, put their life on the line to, fight the weather and everything. And that's what they like to do. And it makes them different. They were a more uncivilized lot for the other 30 years ago, when more bars than churches, and
uh-huh.
people feel rowdy,
and
preaching news and stuff, you go down in the bars, and it was just different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more like a frontier type spirit, frontier character, and they were. And people that were here because they put the mold somewhere else, and so they came here, but they were a higher class or whatever.
So what did they do for diversion?
Now when you go down to the bars, you see that are rowdy and stuff, or uncivilized, they're really uncivilized. and these people were just in love with their life and whatever. It's
okay.
A lot more frontier spirit.
Okay, I know there are some physical changes in the area. Could you name some? Let's go back from the Great Tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
Can ground itself, how would it affect it?
Right, what the water didn't pick out is the manure, the federal government doesn't fund, fund the building of the downtown, and so pretty much everything that was down there either washed away or torn down and replaced with more modern structures. And then Kodiak's kind of grown from there. When I was 13 years old, I remember going duck hunting, and a rabbit hunting up where Silly Plain was.
It
was a lake there. And that was really getting out in the woods. It was going down to Spice Street.
Population wise, about how? So when did you start seeing the arrival of more people?
It's just been gradual. It always amazes me that more people come here because we got seemingly less fish. We used to fish year round here for everything, and now seasons are days instead of months.
During those times when you have a tsunami too, was there a break in your service?
No,
people would still need oil.
I was still